Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, February 26th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, now in a new time slot. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be diving into the kickoff of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, the city's purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm property after years of legal limbo, an update from City Council's last meeting, and the Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser coming up this weekend in support of Lionhearts. Without further delay, let's get into our first story. After a highly anticipated court ruling last week, the City of Kingston is moving forward with the purchase of the property at 2000 Front Road, known to many as Lemoyne Point Farm. The acquisition follows a court-approved settlement reached after years of confidential negotiations related to the property. The city purchased the approximately 80-acre site for $12 million. Jim Biaggi, Chris Cannon, Sheila Mirsky, and Richard Rayburn Gibson of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, a coalition of Kingston residents who have long advocated for the protection of the land, sat down with CFRC to share their history with the property and their thoughts on this latest development.
Jim Biaggi, and I'm with the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, which I've been with since its inception.
I'm Chris Cannon, and there were seven of us who got together right after Mary Fraser died, realizing that the Lemoyne Point Farm might be under pressure of development, and we formed the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group and have since evolved. But Sheila and I had a long history back 35, 36 years ago of back when Lemoyne Point Farm was in Kingston Township. There was pressure to develop 22, 23 acres corner of the farm and build houses and extend sewers, et cetera, et cetera. And we long fought that. Sheila was the head of our Protect Lemoyne Point organization that formed. And I should turn it over to Sheila, but just to say that we would attract 500 people at public meetings in township offices to protect Lemoyne Point from this development.
Hi, I'm Sheila Mirsky, yes. So I was one of many people who have been involved with trying to protect Lemoyne Point Farm for, 36 years. It was really heartwarming to see how much the community wanted that land protected. I mean, back before the internet and before email and all that technology, we were able to get together a petition with 6,000 signatures to present to the then Township Council of Kingston. And we influenced a municipal election result, actually, to keep that development from occurring way back then. So it was a long-standing desire of the community to see that land not turn into a subdivision and to have it remain natural. And ultimately, we were hoping that there could be a public purchase.
Almost an original member of the group, been with them since that same period of time, 2022. And as you know from our website and your previous research, our goal to conserve the field, forest, and shoreline of Lemoyne Point Farm for future generations. The group that Chris mentioned and others have mentioned that it includes seven people is a really spectacular group of talented people that have been doing advocacy work to protect this property.
Thank you all for that background. And again, there's a long history here. After all these years of discussion and advocacy, what does this ruling feel like?
Well, we really think it is good news, and we applaud the city for their persistence in negotiating this purchase of the farm. They've been involved in this for quite some time, and we've been in contact with them. With the politicians, the mayor's office, councilors, senior staff, legal department, for a couple of years as these negotiations have been underway. So it is a remarkable and important milestone that they have finalized the negotiation of this process through the hearing process and so on. And it's an important investment in one of the few remaining natural spaces within the urban boundary of Kingston. And Chris has already talked about how this is you know, so important in terms of preserving this special place, this jewel on Lake Ontario. You know, we're pleased with this step, but you know, we're going to be vigilant in the future to make sure that, you know, our objectives and our objectives in terms of the local and regional community are met.
I'll just echo Richard, and we've worked long and hard, and me and Sheila for 36 years to make sure that it remained an open natural space with public access, and this is a step towards that.
Really, really over the moon that this purchase has happened, and we can now work positively with the community and the city to see that it's properly protected in the long term.
Looking ahead, according to a statement released by the city, the land will remain open to the public and protected while long-term plans are developed with community input. More detailed information is expected to be included in a council report scheduled for March 24th, 2026. The Save Le Moyne Point Farm Group says they plan to continue their advocacy and remain vigilant to ensure the farm's long-term protection.
Yeah, I think we're most concerned about what the process will be to ensure that this this property does remain protected in the long term. As you know, councils change every 4 years, and the future council could easily decide to rezone and sell off part of that property. So that's why I think Richard mentioned that we need to remain engaged and vigilant. But I'm confident that the community is so much in favor of having that remain natural space that I don't think that there's going to be that will ever happen, but we want to not have to remain on guard all the time and see if we can put in place something that will ensure that that could not happen.
Just one more layer on that as well is that Mary Fraser, who was the owner of the farm at the time she died, had long wanted the farm to be public space and not be developed, and had those expressed as wishes in her last will and testament. So I feel we honoring Mary's wishes as well if we are endeavoring to keep it a natural space and keep it on farm and the forests from development.
And moving forward, what kinds of safeguards are you maybe hoping get put in place? Like you guys said, we're almost at the end of this council term. There's going to be lots of changeover in the future. What are some of the measures that you think should be put in place to keep this space safe?
You know, we have looked at legal techniques in the past. One scenario that we've looked at was conservation easements, and this is where you put a registered on title document on file that limits future use, and there could be specifications in that conservation easement. As Sheila says, local councils change, and you know, 10 years might sound like a long time, not to worry, but we're thinking about generations from now and having this place remain a natural area, and protected, these fields and these forests and this unique, very unique shoreline, not until 2040, but you know, beyond the turn of the century and so on. So to have a robust system in place that can be resilient against the puts and takes of politics and economics and everything else needs some protections in place that might be legal documents or other things.
And we must remember the Indigenous practice of always looking 7 generations ahead as you plan. I hope we will continue to do that.
The city has also indicated it will pursue partnerships with organizations such as the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority and other not-for-profit groups. In the city's statement, Mayor Brian Patterson said these partnerships will help ensure the property remains a welcoming and sustainable space, adding that the city looks forward to working with residents to imagine the future of Le Moyne Point Farm.
I think when we talk about how unique and magnificent this gem of a property is. I think the word imagine is really important. This is a, you know, a once in a lifetime opportunity, a generational opportunity to save this property and dream and imagine about, you know, a future in which this type of property exists decades and longer from now. So I may be a little, maybe sounding a little altruistic here, but to encourage Kingstonians and others to imagine that that future is something I'd like to see out of the consultation.
Thanks, Richard. That's a very positive way of putting it, and I agree. And I, you know, we had a community meeting. When was that? 2 years ago, I guess, where there was a visioning exercise of how, you know, for people to imagine how the property might be used in public space. And that information's on our website. But I think for the city to undertake something like that, that would get people's minds churning about what might be done with the space would be wonderful.
As Kingston begins to imagine what comes next for the farm, the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group says they will continue their work, also pointing to the importance of the upcoming municipal elections as a key moment for advocacy and accountability.
The broader agenda of vigilance and looking at approaches to ensure long-term preservation, but, you know, drilling down a little bit, it might be to participate in a consultation that might be happening that the city runs. We will continue to be in contact with our broad base of supporters across Kingston and maybe seek additional advice from them. We are working with an organization called Small Change Fund, and through that have had the ability to receive charitable donations. So we have some funds, and if there's opportunities to hire subject matter experts or others to support the community's work on the future of the farm, we can do that. We'll certainly continue to be active with our newsletter and on social media, keeping people informed. And I think also, you know, we have met, as I said, with politicians and you know, senior staff at the city. We will continue to do that, make sure they're aware of vision for this property. And, you know, it won't be too many months before we might decide we want to pay attention to who's running for municipal council and mayor and see what they're saying about their agenda.
Just to add to what Richard said about reaching out to our local politicians with the elections expected in November and uncertainty around mayoral candidates. At the previous election cycle, we were quite successful reaching out to mayor and councillors from almost all of those people, getting commitments that the farm should be protected from development. So we are likely to be engaging in a campaign during the summer and fall to get commitments again from people running again for council or mayor's positions.
Before we get into more local news this evening, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, February 26th, daytime high of -1, and there is a 60% chance of precipitation. Will vary between snow or rain depending on the time of day and the daytime high, overnight dropping down to -6. Friday, February 27th, daytime high of 3 degrees, dropping to 0 overnight, cloudy all day. Saturday, February 28th, warmest day of the week, daytime high of 5 degrees with cloudy conditions, dropping back down to -9 overnight. Sunday, March 1st, daytime high of -4 with a mix of sun and cloud. And then Monday, March 2nd, looks like we will have more
Winter weather in store. Daytime high of -8 with a 75% chance of snow flurries in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report. Just a reminder, overnight parking restrictions are in effect for the rest of February. Come March 1st, the overnight restrictions will loosen to where overnight parking is only banned when weather conditions require it, i.e. if there is snow or freezing rain in the forecast. Until March 1st, all overnight street parking is banned in the City of Kingston.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is back for another year, with the 2026 edition kicking off last night and running until March 1st. In its 26th year, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival is the largest festival in the world dedicated exclusively to Canadian film. Festival director Mark Garnes sat down with CFRC to chat about the return after last year's big anniversary, what's new this year, and celebrating Canadian content in 2026. We talked a lot in 2025 about how the festival continues to grow. What's new about this edition?
Yeah, it's hard to talk. That's kind of what we're thinking all year. Like, how can we top our 2025 edition, which was our 25th anniversary? And we felt it was a really good one. I think we set box office records, and it felt like it last year really felt like the first full year back after the pandemic. I know we're not even really talking about that anymore, but, like, you know, a lot of arts organizations definitely took a hit through and after the pandemic. And so last year really felt like we were back to where we were in 2019, and we even exceeded that a little bit. And then so far for 2026, we're on track, similar to what we were last year as well, or maybe even a little bit better. So yeah, I kind of feel like the festival's back in the way it was meant to be experienced and on the trajectory that we were on pre-pandemic. And, you know, we're an all-Canadian film festival, so I think sometimes people are kind of like fishing for a theme with a festival. And the nice thing about our festival is it's really just baked into our mission. Like, we show the best all-Canadian films of the year, so that's what people are gonna get again this year. And then all the usual extras that we have, like music and comedy and workshops and panels. So it's, you know, we've got that same dynamic feel to it that we've always had as well.
Awesome. And you kind of got into it there, but I think especially right now, people are really eager to support Canadian content. I was wondering if you could speak to the significance of KCFF being an event that centers Canadian content right now in this cultural moment. And if you've maybe had some conversations about this topic with your team and audiences, creators, et cetera.
Yeah. So, like, again, this is what we've always done for almost 26 years now. So, but it this year and last maybe does feel more timely to be an all Canadian film festival, given, you know, everything that's going on in the world. And I think people may be embracing their Canadianness more so than in my early years with the festival. But I not to keep bringing up the pandemic, but I did really notice during the pandemic when we did the live streams and people were able to watch our films from anywhere. A lot of our geo restrictions we didn't actually have geo restrictions for all our films, so we were able to show a lot of our films overseas and then within Canada, like coast to coast to coast. So a lot of people in Vancouver, Halifax, or up north that may not have normally attended the festival in a regular year were able to check out our festival during those years. And it was interesting to hear the way that they would speak about our festival just in our communications with them or on, like, chats or whatever, or in the Q&As that we did, and, like, talking about KCFF like it was their festival, you know, like having that sense of ownership. And that was the first time it ever dawned on me that anybody from Vancouver or Halifax or up north would think of our festival in that way. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And not to like pump our own tires here, but talking with other festival directors from other festivals, maybe a similar size of KCFF in other cities, they didn't really notice that because, you know, they were maybe an international festival. So they didn't necessarily have that audience from far away latching onto their festival for those reasons. So yeah, maybe that's a long way of saying that I've in recent years noticed people from outside of Kingston really embracing what we do and having a sense of pride and ownership of KCFF, even though they don't live here. And, you know, as the festival's grown and we have more tourists coming to the festival and people from out of town, we're now experiencing that in person as well. So yeah, it's kind of cool to see that.
Yeah, for sure. That's really cool. And I was wondering, kind of related to that, what does it mean to host a national film festival in a city like Kingston, especially as our film industry continues to grow and has a lot of development happening right now?
Yeah, it's really important. I think it helps put Kingston on the map. It's a unique thing. So, you know, we always say we're the globe's largest all-Canadian film festival, which is true, but there aren't really that many that are doing that either. So it is unique in and of itself. And I think, you know, helps set KCFF and Kingston apart. And this is maybe a slightly outdated stat, but I don't think it's changed a whole lot. But it was something like the last stat I heard was 2% of the box office is spent on Canadian films. So when people are going to the Cineplex or Landmark or probably even the Screening Room, although they would do a better job than the commercial theaters for playing Canadian. But it's a very low percentage of films from Canada that are being played in theaters. So, but yeah, a lot of these filmmakers are going overseas, like the Berlin Festival or wherever, major festivals, and winning awards. But yet, right here in Canada, we don't really give Canadian film enough attention. So yeah, I think it just highlights the importance of organization like KCFF playing these films. And then in recent years, you will see more going to Crave. And we used to always say, like, if somebody asks where can I see these after the festival, we're like, go to Classic Video. And that was always our best answer, and it was true. But now, you know, it is more, we'll say, well, go back to the Screening Room. Sometimes we'll show some of our top films after KCFF. But you can see some on Crave now, and the odd film will go to Netflix as well. But a lot of the films that we show are only going to play on the big screen at KCFF. And so I think it's also a rare opportunity if you like the theatrical experience and what festivals offer, things like Q&As. It's like often the only chance to see these films.
Awesome. And kind of to wrap up this section here, for both seasoned attendees and those attending KCFF for the first time this year, what do you hope folks can take away?
I guess just a greater appreciation of Canadian film and how good it is, and hoping maybe that people don't, because things are starting to sell out. I always say to people, if something sells out, go to your second or third choice at the festival, because we'll often have five or six things playing at the same time, and that'll often be your favorite film that you take away from a festival. That's always my experience too. The film that I try to get into and don't, I'll go to my number two or three pick, and that'll end up being something that I just didn't think that I would like or enjoy. So I guess all to say, like, take a chance on things at the festival that you may not normally go to. You know, we've tried to curate it so that there's like really good docs and comedies and like thrillers and whatever you know genre that you're into. There's something for everyone, but also, you know, maybe get outside your comfort zone and go to something that you wouldn't like, and you might be surprised. So yeah, that's kind of a message we always tell people at KCFF. And some people come in for events like, you know, we have July Talk playing, or we have K. Trevor Wilson from Letterkenny doing comedy, or we have a workshop component and a whole creative industries day. So if you come in through those arms of the festival, you know, take a chance on something else as well. There's no matter what path of entry you have into the festival, I think there's lots of other things to do once you're there.
Once again, that was Mark Garnes, director of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, on what attendees can expect from this 2026 edition. Council has unanimously approved $3 million in funding for the development of Tricolor Labs, a shared industry-ready wet lab and biomanufacturing facility planned for Botterill Hall at Queen's University. Ben McGillwam with Kingston Economic Development Corporation spoke to the demand for the facility and the benefit of having it in Kingston.
So the primary users of the lab are going to be fully funded commercializing stage life sciences companies looking for lab space, spinouts from the university and the college, and then other regional spinouts looking for BSL2 lab space, and scaling life science companies within the region looking for short-term leases anywhere from 10 weeks to over a year. And then foreign direct investments looking for lab space to enter the North American market, kind of hitting the ground running. Tricolor Labs, addresses a clear market demand across Ontario. There's a lack of wet lab space, especially the BSL2 for companies. And Kingston in particular has a severe lack of this space. The Tricolor Labs will integrate quite well with the Kingston ecosystem, the strengths that are Queen's University, the biotech program that's at St. Lawrence College, and the city's vision for a long-term health campus around a new hospital. This will be a feeder to that space. Kingston has a strong area of research and early stage innovation in the life sciences. We have programs like Dun & Desponsay's Queen's Innovation, a build-to-scale life science program where we see companies spinning out IP from the university into new businesses. Leveraging the research strengths that's at Queen's University and a lot of the equipment that is there that life science companies want.
Jesse Coobs with Economic Development at Queen's University also spoke before council to how Queen's is uniquely positioned to meet this demand for lab space.
Queen's University is uniquely positioned to host Tricolor Labs. It has established programs and offers entrepreneurial and IP support necessary for early stage companies. The campus has established BSL 1 and 2 wet lab infrastructure, specialized equipment, and full biosafety and waste management framework already in place. It also has state-of-the-art animal facilities that help bridge the preclinical gap that often exists for startups. And importantly, Queen leads numerous clinical trials locally and internationally, meaning companies have the ability to plug directly into clinical research pathways as well. The eighth floor of Bottle Hall provides an ideal foundation for Tricolor Labs footprint. It already contains existing BSL 1 and 2 wet lab space, autoclaves, fume hoods, waste systems, all connected by secure card access hallways. The vision is to update and modernize the existing space into flexible modular suites similar to smart labs style facilities that are in global innovation centers, enabling multiple firms to collate safely with direct access to Queen's core facilities. Second floor is another area that's been designated with an open concept layout, growth-friendly space, ideal for companies looking for collaborative and scalable workspace. Shared equipment that is essential that would be cost prohibitive for companies, but it allow companies to grow and collaborate.
McIlwain and Coobs were given another opportunity to highlight the university's unique positioning for this project when asked by council how much this project would cost without the existing infrastructure at Queen's.
So I think the ballpark of that would be around $1,500 a square foot. Just to renovate it was over $1,000 a square foot, plus the planning and permitting, and then finding the space that would fit the needs.
I'll just add quickly, to set up a biosafety level 2 building without the infrastructure would be millions and millions of dollars. The opportunity here is that we'll leverage existing infrastructure that is multi-million dollars of equipment and already established programs that we can leverage.
The funding is conditional on securing and maintaining additional government funding, finalizing governance and oversight structures, and executing formal funding and collaboration agreements between the City of Kingston, Kingston Economic Development Corporation, and Queen's University. The city's contribution will be limited to capital and equipment costs only, with no responsibility for operating, maintenance, or life cycle expenses. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This February, find where live art meets extended reality. Single Thread Theater presents PXR 2026, a mix of live performances, interactive digital presentations, technical deep dives, and exciting installations right here in Kingston at Modern Fuel, The Tet, and at Fort Henry. Get whisked away into immersive worlds like snowy cities, cyberpunk dystopias, musical mushrooms, and coastal shores. The conference runs February 20th through March 1st. Learn more by following Single Thread Theater on Instagram and get your tickets now via performanceandxr.com. See you there.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. We're back after our 1 week break. Today I'm joined with Dylan Katmarian and Jack Stubbs, Kyle and Sam's epic replacements, as Kyle and Sam are very busy, I guess we could say, at the moment. So I know they've been a little absent, but I promise you guys they will be back sooner rather than later. In the meantime, we've got a freshly shaven Dylan Katmarian. I just want to highlight that. If you guys could see, if we recorded this, you would see the most glorious looking man right now. Personally, I would like the beard back, but I know his girlfriend has other plans. And Jack Stubbs, looking very dapper today. He was wearing a tie. We should call him Mr. Stubbs, as he is known to his children at Regiopolis Notre Dame.
Go Jags. Or not go Jags, go Panthers.
We might have to have Mr. Stubbs in a couple weeks for our first international guest. He might have to call in as he's off to Costa Rica in a couple days.
I learned pretty recently it's Costa Rica.
Costa Rica.
I've been pronouncing it wrong my entire life. But
our look first at that. Plugged in my ears fact check of the day.
There we go. Call him Jamie. All right. So now we're going to get started. We're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to talk a lot about the Olympics. We had a lot going on these past 2 weeks. A lot of controversy, a lot of joy, a lot of sadness. I mean, it was mixed feelings. I feel like you get that with all whenever the Olympics come around, but especially with the Winter Olympics and being Canadian, I feel like we had a lot of personal investment into this Olympics. It's almost like we're out there playing, but
I felt like that. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
We'll get into it.
Okay. So I know we want to start with the medal count because that's what everyone cares about. And honestly, Canada wasn't quite as good as other past Olympics. This one was I don't want to say disappointment at all. I think that our athletes competed hard. We won a good amount of medals, but just compared to some of the other countries on the board, it was just not even close. But I know, Jack, you've got it pulled up. Looking at this top 11 or so.
Specifically top 11.
Who stands out to you? Who's there? Especially that 11th place country.
For those of you who are unaware, Canada actually placed 11th overall.
Woo!
9th in the total medal count, but because of 5 golds and 7 silvers, us Canadians were placed down there at the 11 mark, losing out to Japan by 3 bronze medals, and then it's Austria, Switzerland, Sweden, France, Germany. Big surprise there, but amazing showing from them. Italy, the host country, actually came top 4, which I think is incredible. The Netherlands, the U.S., and say what you will, but congratulations to the U.S. And of course, we have Norway at the top. And Norway's a really, really amazing kind of showing here because of the way they develop sports in their country, you know, making them mostly uncompetitive until that high school age, focusing on the fundamentals and the fun of the sport before actually bringing in some competition as the kids get older. And they also wipe the floor in cross-country skiing. So
they do.
They're unreal.
They almost, it's like they have the sport named after them. Nordic skiing.
Hey.
Yeah. No. But Norway, yeah. They're the all-time leading Winter Olympic medal leaders. They've always dominated. And I think it does, as you mentioned, Jack, I think that it really goes to show the different attitude that they have towards their youth sports can have major implications when it comes to dominating the Olympic Games. And it is cool too, because yes, the US came second and they're kind of the complete opposite of the spectrum when it comes to intensity of youth sports, but they still lost by 8 medals to Norway. So it really wasn't even close. Norway, again, the Winter Olympic champions. Any thoughts on Italy and their surprise showing? Because personally, I did not expect Italy to be this strong in the Winter Olympics. It must be like a home host country kind of thing, because I remember when Canada hosted in 2010 in Vancouver, they performed almost, I think it was their best Olympics to date. So I'm not completely surprised by this showing from Italy, but again, I didn't expect this many medals for them to finish this high. Dylan, any thoughts on Italy?
Yeah, I mean, you have that incentive to win, you know, represent your country, represent, you're hosting the Olympics, so, you know, put on a show. And I think that, you know, people might not consider Italy this prototypical winter sport country, but when you consider the role that the Alps and the mountainous regions play in many of these winter sports, downhill skiing particularly, you know, it does make some sense. They do have some mountains. There is access to snow.
Mm-hmm.
So once I thought about that, it makes some sense. And I mean, looking at the stats here, they actually succeeded really well in speed skating and alpine skiing, as I mentioned before.
Yeah.
So, I mean, congrats to them. Italy brought their A game.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And I do think it might have also, like, as you mentioned, they have a lot of resources in the host country, too. They probably get first dibs at testing out some of the facilities, too.
Oh.
So I think the home court advantage is definitely prevalent in the Olympics. Were there any countries that we were surprised didn't perform, maybe other than Canada, as up to standards? I know one country that I saw was Great Britain. I don't know why, but I kind of always thought that they do well in the Summer Olympics, but
yeah.
I kind of thought that they would do a little bit better. They got 5 medals. It was the 3 gold, 1 bronze, and 1 silver. So still dominant in some areas, but that was one that stood out to me.
How many countries are represented in total?
I think there were about 140, or 120 to 140, if
plus
I'm not
you have,
mistaken.
You have solo athletes and then athletes who are not representing a country, but representing like themselves, the independents.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. The independents. I think that where did they finish ranked?
So many.
They did all right, too. They were, I think they won a couple medals, the independent athletes.
Cool.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, nice to see. I mean, it was a great Olympic experience in my eyes. I mean, I look at going back and seeing there's a lot of really positive energy going on at the Olympics this year.
Mm-hmm.
In such a tough geopolitical time, the Olympics really did bring people together, I thought, up until maybe the last day of the Olympics. I think that you saw Olympians like Eileen Gu, who dominated again in skiing, in the alpine skiing, and you saw some backlash that she was receiving for representing China over America, as she was born in the States but has Chinese ancestors. And you know, she was just calm, cool, and collected the whole time when she was being interviewed about it. And I think that that's what a lot of Olympians don't often get, the screen time or the clicks or the videos when they're doing their national championships. But as soon as the Olympics come around, all of a sudden everyone's a critic of every sport, right? Mm-hmm. Even I found myself, I'm like, oh, look at this. Look at that snowboard move. That looked really good. Actually, that was last place, you know? So like, I feel like the Olympics really do bring everyone together. Even though there might be some controversies surrounding them.
Mm-hmm.
One controversy that we're going to talk about was the, as a whole, I guess we can talk about Olympic hockey as kind of being controversial. And there's a lot of different controversies within this controversy. I think the too many men on the ice and refereeing as a whole was disappointing for me.
Back-to-back games against Canada, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not even like, I know, yeah, it sure it affected Canada, but really it didn't at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But the refereeing as a whole was kind of disappointing. I think that I watched a bunch of the other games, even like the first Slovakia-Finland game. Like, there were calls that I thought should be made or would have been made in like the NHL, and also calls that would have been made in international hockey. Now, I don't know if you guys were able to take a look at it, but what they did was they brought referees from the NHL and referees from the IIHF. So you had two sets of referees. There were equal amounts in each game. So two NHL, two IIHF, and they were expected to call the game the same way. And I think that is unrealistic and unfair to the referees, first off, because it's two different games. And we've talked about on this podcast before how international hockey is completely different from the NHL hockey. But I think because of the ice surface being NHL-sized and not international-sized, they felt like they needed to bring in the NHL reffing. And honestly, it might be consistent because NHL reffing hasn't been fantastic recently. But yeah, there were a few controversies. Czechia game, too many men on the ice, literally six people in the celebration circle. Mm-hmm. Like,
That's pretty blatant.
I couldn't get over it. And like, where's the, if you're going to call an NHL game and ref it by NHL rules, where's the challenge for that? Why was there no challenge available for that? Why did Canada not challenge it? It very, very shocking to me. I don't really know how to explain it. I haven't really seen that in an NHL game ever.
That was unbelievable. I remember watching the goal in real time and thinking, where's the coverage on the third man back?
Yeah.
And now we know why.
And we know why. Yeah. No, I couldn't believe it. That game was a roller coaster. Czechia always trying to like end Canada's seasons. I mean, we saw it in the World Juniors. We saw it in this game almost. But after a dominant win in the group stage, I really thought Canada was going to walk away with it. Czechia played really strong. And I mean, say what you want about Nick Suzuki, but he had to play hero and bail Canada out. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it was overall
incredible,
a good game.
Fashion as well.
It was a crazy tip. It was a good play.
And it wasn't just the tip too. That whole shift, you know, he brought it in deep and he held on to it.
Yeah.
And he was the reason Canada made it past the quarterfinals.
I mean, yeah, it could have looked completely different if Canada was down in the quarterfinals. I think a lot of Canadians have been a lot more angry than they were now with the result of the gold medal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but before we get into the gold medal game, I think we should talk about some bright spots for the Team Canada team. I think Connor McDavid, tournament MVP, and just a stellar Olympic run. I mean, I'm pretty sure he had a point per period at one point, and it was like 12 points in 12 periods, which is absolutely ridiculous. Like, that is one hell of a player. Really the most deserving of a medal. And a Stanley Cup, in my opinion. I think that if this guy never wins a Stanley Cup, it would floor me. But he just showed why he's the best player in the world by dominating this tournament. But he was also a calming presence out there. I think he was a good captain when Crosby went down. He stepped up. And I know he's not the most vocal guy all the time, but I do think that his leadership is definitely underplayed when you consider Connor McDavid. Really think of his skill, his speed. I think leadership is also pretty high up there for him, and you could tell by the way that they played. Any thoughts on the Finland game? Because I know that was one where you really wish you had Crosby on the ice for that game. It turned out okay for Canada. They were able to turn it around, but after trailing for that long, do you think the leadership of McDavid really played a significant role, or was it the depth? Because I know a lot of Canadians are crediting the depth of the team. It can be both, but any thoughts on that, Dill or Jack?
You know, it's unbelievable. People really hate to give McJesus his credit. In a best-on-best tournament, he was, you know, by any metric you want, eye test, points, I'm sure the advanced stats reflect it.
Oh, yeah.
This guy is the best player in the world right now, and he has been for quite some time.
Yeah.
I can't believe how fast he moves. Every single time he gets the puck, he's unmatched in every single facet of the game. And it was honestly, despite the outcome, such a pleasure to watch him play on the world stage. I'm happy about that. I'm happy we got to witness it.
It was a pleasure to watch all the NHL players at the world
Seriously.
Stage. Like really, I really did take it for granted when I watched back in 2010 and 2014. Yeah. And as soon as I turned on that first game, Slovakia, Finland, and I was like, oh yeah, we're back. Like, this is awesome to see. Like, this is really best on best hockey that we haven't seen in a really long time. And I mean, it was really it really brought up my spirits, you know, during these cold winter months of February. And only one way to cheer you up is definitely some Olympic hockey. Now, the gold medal game. It's a great game.
It's a phenomenal game. Maybe even the greatest hockey game I've ever seen in my life.
I would second that.
You and I got to watch in a pretty stellar format.
Yeah.
You know, they pulled me by my ankles out of bed at 7:15, and we marched downtown to get a 8-man reserve table at a local bar.
Shout out Aaron.
There was not a soul there cheering for the U.S. So yeah. Even if you know they lost 27-0,
yeah,
I would have been stoked just to be there.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, it was 1-1 for the entirety of the third period, the greatest period in hockey I've ever seen in my entire life, that had no goals in it. Yeah. And we got to watch in overtime in the Olympics in the gold medal game. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. The fact that it was that riveting in a game with 3 total goals scored. And my heart rate was just through the roof the whole time.
Yeah.
And you talk about the modern game, and these guys have been playing their entire lives. You could very well say that that is the most skilled game of hockey ever played.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't disagree with anything you guys said. That it was a, like, when I was watching this, it just felt different than like anything I'd seen, like any hockey game. Now, I do want to say, it wasn't a 50-50 battle.
The ice was tilted.
The ice was tilted. And when I mean that this was the best hockey game I've ever seen, I think this is one of the best hockey games Team Canada has ever played.
And they lost.
So many chances. So many amazing chances. But who do we have to give the flowers to?
Connor Hellebuyck played incredible. One of the best, if not the best, goaltending performance in Olympic history.
What do you do?
And he's competing with prime Carey Price, who shut out the semifinals and the gold medal game, back-to-back games in 2014. I still think Hellebuyck played overall better, was more valuable to his team. Because that game is not 1-1 going into... That's not 1-1 without him.
I saw somewhere that given average goaltending... Team Canada had an expected goals of something like 5 or 5.5.
Does not surprise me at all. Like, just an insane. He faced 42 shots in that game. And really, honestly, like, I know McDavid won MVP and McDavid deserved MVP. Like, but it would have been so hard if I was on that panel to not vote for Connor Hellebuyck to win Olympic MVP, because that gold medal doesn't go to the States without him. If you have any other goalie in there, I don't think you're getting the same result. And it's not even to say that Connor Hellebuyck has been historically that level. He's been fantastic goalie. I mean, there's a reason he was the starter for the States, but I've never seen Connor Hellebuyck play like that in my life.
Has anybody?
Like, no, I don't think so. Like,
talk about peaking at the right time.
What an incredible showing. What an incredible athletic feat. Because you have, like, think of all of the different goals that could have been. You know, Celebrini breakaway. McDavid had 2 in the game, you know. One was overthought, but still, amazing save from Hellebuyck.
Yeah.
So where do we go if he's not there? You know, if Jordan Binnington played a great game.
Absolutely.
If roles are reversed, it could easily be 10-1.
Yeah.
You know?
No. I honestly think it was the game and, like, everybody knowing how much was riding on this game. Like, that's got to be pure adrenaline going. And, like, for pure adrenaline for the States goaltending and for Canada's offense. Because adrenaline can go both ways sometimes. Like, you saw Nathan MacKinnon have an empty net right there. The adrenaline gets going a little too much. You get a little too antsy. He missed a wide-open net.
It happens to the
best. You can't blame him. Like, it happens to the best of us. Nathan MacKinnon's hitting that 9 out of 10 times. Mm-hmm. And, like, because of the global stage that we were watching this on, I don't think it's crazy to say that moments like those are going to happen.
Always.
And I do want to point out that Connor Hellebuyck actually got an assist on the game-winning goal, too.
What a stud.
So can this guy get even better? I honestly don't think so. Let's talk a little bit about the goals. So that first goal by Matt Boldy was one of the best Olympic hockey goals I've ever seen.
On the top D pairing, too.
Splitting
just killed me.
Makar and Taves. I mean, there's never been a more deserving goal than that. Like, when I was watching that, I'm like, yeah, you know what? He embarrassed us. That was an incredible play. I can't be mad at anything that Canada did on that.
Your steez.
Honestly.
Style from the second he touched the puck with his stick
to when it went into, what was it, like the bottom left corner? What hole is that? Seven hole? Who knows?
The wrong hole is what it was. So it, but it went in a hole and it did not come out of the net. But it was just a fantastic. It's a fantastic example of what defense has turned into in professional hockey. Boldy's a defenseman, right? So that's Boldy's a defenseman?
No, I think you're thinking of Faber.
I'm thinking
maybe.
Of Faber. Okay, that changed my point completely. Brock Faber still does some pretty cool stuff on offense, but Matt Boldy, still Minnesota Wild. Like, that was a great goal, and you don't see it like that too often.
Well, and it speaks to the bright young future that of USA Hockey. The kid's like something like 24.
Yeah.
So much of the USA team was very young, and the young stars came out to play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it really was. And that's a difference between Canada and the States, too, because Canada did take a lot of older talent minus Macklin Celebrini.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying there's anything wrong with that. Canada still had a great tournament, silver medal. But there were some younger studs, Matthew Schaefer, Connor Bedard, that really might have played better at the Olympics. And there's some players on Team Canada that we haven't talked about it yet, but there were some players that didn't really play up to expectations.
It's funny, right? Because how can you be critical of the team building when Team Canada had such a dominant performance? In they looked more dominant in the gold medal game than they did in their Czechia and Finland games by far.
Absolutely.
Talk about peaking at the right time.
Completely different team and without Crosby.
Yeah.
So, like, It is hard to critique the team building, but at key moments, key players did not show up. Not in the America game, in the other games. Mm-hmm. In the group stage games, there was some sloppiness from certain Sam Bennett players and Brendan Hagel. Both of those guys did not have their best tournaments, still very valuable members of the team. But, and I don't want to blame that four-minute penalty on Bennett, because that was a tough penalty to take, and they killed it off, so it doesn't matter. You can't do much about that when you're falling into the boards and you've got your stick going like that. Mm. Unlucky, if anything. But I do think that I was impressed with Tom Wilson's play, because so I thought Tom Wilson should not be on Team Canada before this. And because it's not a fighting tournament, it's not a physical tournament, he laid one of the biggest hits I've seen in Olympic history.
Smoked him.
In that game.
What a hit. And completely
Dylan Larkin.
Legal.
Completely
like,
legal.
And it looked like he did it by accident. If you look back at it, he's just like, oh, whoops.
Yeah.
And hey, that's what he does best. And honestly, sense of pride there.
Absolutely.
You know, you put a dirty player, and like we all can say that he's objectively a dirty player.
Yeah.
Played a clean game.
Clean tournament.
For like, as best as we can say it.
Yeah.
Clean tournament even.
Yeah.
And, you know, we come out looking, I feel a different way about him now.
Absolutely. I think I feel differently about a lot of players after this final game.
So do I.
Yeah.
Where are you going with that, Mr.
You know, I want to talk about, you know, we aren't a political podcast, but sports and politics are very connected, and it's never been more on display than the Olympic gold medal hockey game, because we had a few instances where the American team did some questionable things in the locker room. And you can say what you want about the Cash Patel being invited. Like, that's really, like, it doesn't surprise me, because it's America. It doesn't surprise me. Kachuk is buddies with him, whatever. Like, the thing that really surprised and hurt me as a sports fan was the treatment of the U.S. women's team.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you can say, oh, whatever, a joke's a joke. Like, that phone call, you know, it's just Trump being funny. But it's not. It's not funny.
Heavily decorated, you know,
heavily
like
decorated.
For years, for generations at this point, current gold medal winning women's team.
Yeah, this isn't new for them. This is new for the men's team.
This is
men's team hasn't won jack poop
years.
Since 1980.
Absolutely not.
So
two gold medals in Olympic hockey ever.
Yeah. I'm just saying. I thought it was incredibly showing, and it was telling of some of the American players. I know some of them. We're not going to really pick on names. I don't think we're really about shaming anyone on here, even if they deserve to be shamed. But there were some players that I do think definitely I have a different taste for now than previously. Anyways,
it's well. Hold on.
Okay, Dylan. Our Dylan's bringing
Dylan
it back.
Gets his speak. Absolutely.
It's interesting to think about how some of those players might be greeted back to Canadian franchises. you know, people like Brady Tkachuk, Austin Matthews.
Yeah.
How can you say sports and politics aren't intertwined when this does feel like some statement, you know, attending the State of the Union address? Is that what it is?
Attending the State of the Union in the White House.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It. You're absolutely right, Dylan. Like, there's so many alternatives that you could have done. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this, and I talked to a few friends about this. If I was on that American winning team, and Donald Trump came on the phone, I don't think I'm getting anywhere close to that. And I don't even think that's crazy to say as an American. Because there's, I mean, we've talked about approval ratings, but like, his approval ratings aren't great in the States right now.
Not
so
good at all.
It's not crazy to say that the average American dislikes Donald Trump. So I don't think it's crazy to be not flattered by the president. And that's what Quinn Hughes and Jack Hughes came out with statements talking about, like, the overall thing. And Jack Hughes was saying, oh, like, how are you going to reject an invitation from the president of the United States? Like, that's crazy. Like, I don't care about politics. Like,
follow
the
women's example, dude. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Honestly, U.S. women's decided not to accept the invite. And I think that was a great decision. And honestly, if a lot of these... Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm going to stop because it is just a crazy showing. And I do think that we've avoided politics on this podcast a decent amount. Obviously, stuff came up with like the FIFA World Cup, and we've talked about it with different soccer. But this one really hit close to home because it was hockey, and it is very Canadian related. So
I'm unhappy.
Yeah,
I'm unhappy with that showing, and I feel like it's okay for the three of us to say that.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. No. All right, we've got 2 minutes left. Anything you guys want to talk about? We can talk about the Cale Makar goal, because that was a gross goal.
Holy snipe!
Yeah, that was a snipe.
I don't think there's much more to say than that. Just,
not really.
Just how do you beat a brick wall? You put it in the perfect spot.
Yeah, no, it was a fantastic goal. I mean, he just walked the line and then all the way down the side and put it in. It was. I mean, I don't think you can't score a better goal than that, especially on a goalie that had been a brick wall, as you said, Dylan, the entire game. Yeah.
I want to circle back. I know we haven't talked about the golden goal, but talk about Canada's depth in this tournament a little bit. You know, I've been seeing some of the stars, like notably McDavid and McKinnon, getting some flack for, you know, choking, air quotes. But what do you say about putting the best team together that's maybe ever played hockey and having that top line shoulder like 25 minutes a game?
Yeah.
I don't think that's totally on them.
No, I really don't think. And I think a lot of Canadians that do think that they're not watching the games. They've got narratives going on in their heads. They're listening to some things and they aren't watching the games because those players really didn't have too much of a choice. And if you watch them when they were on the ice, they were the best players on the ice the whole time. 25 out of 25 minutes, no matter who was on the other side, they were the best players. Like, even if you're not scoring a goal, doesn't mean you're not a great player and you're doing everything you can to score. The depth was great for Canada. But I think the stars showed up. I really do. I can't really critique too much. We'll talk about for 30 seconds about the game-winning goal. Great shot, Jack Hughes.
Great
hope your tooth is fine. Like,
pretty badass picture though.
It was pretty
awesome.
Cool.
Really awesome. I love my country.
Yeah, me too.
I love my country. You know, despite everything, I'm a proud Canadian.
Yeah.
Post Olympics.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Plugged in my ears here. Number one fans of Canada. You heard it here first. Go Canada, go.
Booyah.
All right, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks.
Winter in Kingston can be unpredictable, but a little preparation can help keep your home safe and your utilities running smoothly. If you live in a house, be mindful of where you shovel snow. Keep fire hydrants visible so emergency crews can access them quickly. Avoid piling snow against gas meters or outdoor vents, as blocked vents can lead to dangerous carbon monoxide buildup. Be prepared for power outages. Keep flashlights and batteries handy, charge your devices in advance, and never use propane stoves, barbecues, or generators indoors. They can produce deadly carbon monoxide. And remember, our crews work in all kinds of weather to keep your utilities running. Help keep them safe by slowing down near work zones and giving them space to do their job. For more winter safety tips, visit utilitieskingston.com. Stay safe and stay prepared.